when my son trotted out the first time in a major league game, it's the greatest sports moment of my life. And, you know, and I was introduced in three Super Bowls and got to play. And I consider those and those rings garbage. It's just, they don't even matter compared to watching your own flesh and blood get to pitch in a major league game. You know, called out of the bullpen.
Welcome to The Art of Fatherhood, a podcast that takes you on the journey of fatherhood. Now here's your host, Art Eddy.
Art Eddy here for The Art of Fatherhood, and I am so excited to team up Art of Fatherhood podcast sponsorship with Busy Kid. I got one of the founders, Greg Merced, with me right now. Greg, people can hear your fatherhood journey on the podcast that we had as well, but tell the good folks why people should use Busy Kid.
You know, I would say get your kid busy doing stuff that actually matters, not just messing around, okay? Get them busy learning how money works so that one day they can leave your house and never come back, okay? That is the goal, and we want to empower them. This is your kid's first job with direct deposit. Make it happen. It's easy. I think what it'll do is it'll empower your kid to be smart with their money.
And that's all we want. We want our kids to be great. We want them to have positive and fun, fulfilling lives. Busy Kid can help them with that as well. So listen to what Greg says. For more information, go to busykid.com, and we appreciate their sponsorship here at the Art of Fatherhood podcast. What's up, everybody? Art Eddy here for the Art of Fatherhood podcast online. I'm very happy to have Mark Schlierer. Thanks for taking the time to chat with me, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing good, Art. How are you, my friend?
Doing really well. Big fan of your work, of course, in the league, and then of course Fox and acting and all this other stuff. We're gonna get even to your chilies and queso, man. I'm a big queso fan, so we're gonna be talking about that as well. Love bringing guys like yourself that really care about fatherhood. So I want to learn more about your fatherhood journey. So thank you for taking the time. Talk about when you found out. I know your kids are a little bit older than mine. You have three kids. I have two daughters. I know you have two daughters and a son. When you found out you're going to be a dad for the first time, sir, what was going through your mind?
Obviously we were very young, but very excited. And I had a great example, man. I had great parents, very loving parents, very involved parents. And so, it was one of those things that I was excited to have the opportunity to be called dad. And, it's a huge responsibility. Anybody can father a child. It takes, a man to be a dad to a child. So I was always excited about that. My wife and I, funny, we always had the kind of same philosophical approach to, kind of what we believed and how we believed. And part of it was for me and my wife was, I am not going to, I'm not going to outsource the raising of my children to anybody else. We're going to do it. And in doing that, you muddle through some things, you make some mistakes along the way. But, it's interesting. One of the things is I'm traveling around the United States and I do a lot of corporate kind of level public speaking and a lot of different things. One of the questions that always comes up is, what'd you do to spend quality time with your kids? And my answer is always the same. It's always standard. I go, anytime I set an hour aside to spend some quality time with my kids, they did something to piss me off. Right. And then it's no longer quality time. And my whole process and my wife's whole process was quantity time. Like, I'm not going to miss anything. I coached my daughter's soccer teams all growing up. I coached my son's baseball team all growing up. We were at everything, and that was kind of our process. We were always together. I didn't do everything right. We didn't. But one thing my kids could never complain about, they could never say I wasn't there or their mom wasn't there because we were always there.
Love it. All right. Just quickly, just because I coach my daughters in different sports and all that. And sometimes there'd be co-coaches, right? So for you coaching your kids in sports, and I know wasn't football, but it was like baseball and soccer. Was it tough for them to take constructive criticism from you, but maybe other coaches, if you were working, they're like, okay. And you're like, I just said the same thing. I just want to know if you have the same thing that I experienced.
Yeah. Without question, my big thing was always effort. I just wanted effort. And sometimes, especially with my son, I treat him like he was a professional player at 12, right? and so there's a lot of things. I mean, I have made so many apologies for the way I coached him growing up because I was exceptionally demanding, but he was exceptionally talented, And so it was always one of those things that I look back on it now and go, okay, well, I really screwed some things up. But the bottom line was I was always there, And it's funny because you know, we had this conversation. I had this conversation with parents in college. And it's probably a little bit different now than it was when I was coming up and even when my son was coming up. But some of the parents were upset about the way the coach talked to the kids. And I'm like, well, let me ask you a question. And, you know, they wanted a mutiny. You know, they're going to go to the president of the school. And I'm like, let me ask you a question. Does your son aspire to be a professional ball player? Well, yes. I go, you think this is bad? I go, wait till you get into the minors. Wait till you get in the, like, come on, like, let them work through it. They'll be okay. They're big boys. Let them get some thick skin and, you know, we'll figure it out. So, yeah, needless to say, there were some times that I was a bit out of control, but, you know, like I said, I'm at least I'm man enough to come to my son on multiple occasions and say, you know what? I really screwed up. It's funny when he got drafted and he was like 6 weeks in the minor leagues before he was in the big leagues. And then he got traded that off season to Detroit and they sent him down to the minor leagues for a couple of months. And he was all, I mean, he was just all irritated about it. Right. And so I'm going to swoop in and I'm going to go to Toledo and I'm going to, you know, kind of prop him up and give him, you know, kind of a motivational speech. Right. And so I'm like, hey, listen, son, you know, you gotta show, like, you gotta work out, you gotta be in the gym early, you know, you gotta do your cardio, you gotta da 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 da. And he's just looking at me like, you have no, this is not football, this is baseball, you have no idea. And so then I'm irritated, right? So, cause like, what do you mean? How you disrespect me? You know, I play for, you know, I'm an old man, you know, Black Sox, Calgary Clouds. And so I spent a couple of days kind of just going through the minor league routine. And, you know, you show up, you show up at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, you're shagging fly balls, you're there all day. Then you do this, you know, you do your arm exercises, your work. And then he was closing games. So, you know, by the time the game, you know, is at 7:30, you know, first pitch, by the time you get to him in the ninth inning, it's, you know, it's 10:30, 11. And then he's got an hour worth of exercise to do after the game, ice in and exercises. Then we go grab something to eat. And there's only one kind of restaurant bar open in town in Toledo, right? So every night it's chicken wings and, you know, and sliders and, you know, I mean, it's garbage, right? And then, you know, by the time you get done eating, you go back to the hotel and you lay in bed and you watch SportsCenter and you look at the clock and it's 3 o'clock in the morning. And then you wake up and, you know, you sleep till the crack of noon and you have something, a sandwich really quick, that jam down your gullet. And after 3 days of hanging with him in the minor league schedule, I just looked at him and go, scrap pile everything I ever told you, just survive. I go, just survive. It's just, it's about survival. I mean, it is a brutal schedule, brutal.
So I really appreciate that story. Thank you very much for sharing that. And, you know, you've won three Super Bowl rings, right? Mm-hmm. Two with the Broncos, one with the Redskins. So hard work. And if people know you and people follow you, they know that hard work and, you know, dedication are some of the values, you know, that you're probably instilling your kids. And then also, too, like you said, you're mad enough to, like, hey, maybe football is totally different than baseball and training. And you saw that, right? So you're also admitting that, like, hey, maybe I was wrong is another great value. But, so, you know, just talking to you right now and listening to what you and your wife are looking to do with your kids, talk about some of the other values you're looking to instill into them.
Well, I think there's always, you know, hard work was always something that we wanted them to have an understanding of, and that that was, you know, that's part of life's requirement. You know, my dad used to tell me all the time, if a man don't eat, he don't work, or if a man don't work, he don't eat. And he said to me, I'm like 8 years old, right? I mean, we affectionately call him Poolside. My dad was an absolute freak, but, you know, just a great man, one of the hardest working men I know, and dedicated, you know, to whatever it is that he is doing, whether it's his work, his workouts, his wife, his home, he's just got complete and total dedication. And so that was always something that, you know, that I wanted to instill in my kids as well is, you know, life is hard, man. You got to be willing to put your nose to the grindstone and you got to be willing to work. So that was always a big part of it. The other thing that my wife and I always wanted to do was we always wanted to be there, you know, and it's crazy. I used to call it stealing time from my kids. My kids never rode the bus. And, you know, I think, well, I'll take that back. They rode the bus like for, I mean, half a week, like 3 days.
Yeah.
And then they realized it wasn't very cool. So, you know, they were done with, but there was a purpose behind it. And the purpose was I could steal 15 minutes from them. And so even when I was playing, you know, on Tuesdays, we have our day off. I take them to school. I pick them up. You know, Mondays, I could take them to school because we come in after, you know, after the game later. Wednesday, Thursday, I couldn't, but Friday I could pick them up. And the whole process was I could steal that 15 minutes. So instead of, you know, debriefing or whatever in the bus with their friends, they get in the car and they'd be like, oh, Dad, you wouldn't believe what happened today at school, right? And so now there's a connection there. There's you know, and it's just one of those things. You will never, ever be disappointed as you look back in life and say, oh, I'm pissed that I missed a quarter of that football game. You know, I used to drive home and I'd be, I mean, I was with Washington and I was beat. I mean, packed in ice, my back, my knees, my elbows. And I'd pull in a driveway and there'd be a 5-gallon bucket sitting in the front yard with my catcher's mitt on. You know, my son's 11 or 10. And I'm like, well, I guess I'm catching a bullpen before dinner, you know, and he just beat the living piss out of my shins with, you know, errant fastballs. But it's like you will never, ever be disappointed. You never look back on life and say, boy, I wish I didn't spend that time with my kids. You know, I'd really like to see that quarter of the basketball game or whatever. Just was always wanted to be there, always wanted to be involved, always wanted, you know, to be able to spend that time. And so, you know, my wife and I had the same kind of philosophical approach. I think the other thing was we looked at the things we loved about our childhood and we tried to implement them into our marriage and into our kids. And then the things we didn't like, you know, the things that weren't great. Like my dad always came home, he would work and then he would lift. And so he'd always come home. He'd be home like at 8:30 in the evening. So we never sat and had a meal together as a family. You know, it was always like, it was always, my mom would make a dish and it'd be on the oven. It's kind of self-serve and eat when you're ready to eat. And I didn't like that as a kid. So I just demanded that we sit together as a family and eat. I just thought that was important. I thought it was something that I missed that I could change for my own kids. And so, and like I said, my parents did the best they could and they were wonderful parents, awesome parents. But I looked at that one little thing and said, man, I'm going to change that when I become a parent.
Yeah.
And so that, those are the things that we kind of always just wanted to be kind of together and support one another.
Yeah. Having a meal together is great because especially, and like you said, picking your kids up from school and they have a chance to vent and you're there taking that in is great. Like I wrote an article on my site about like the benefits of being a taxi driver for your kids because you can shut the music off. My kids don't have phones just yet. And so we're just talking about life in general and they're just sharing everything that they want. And then also too, at dinner, no one's got their phones. Everyone's, you know, just chilling and right. You're having a nice meal and you're talking about your day. And it's not like, yes, good, sure, right. Fine. You're having those,
right. Yeah. Like, those questions. I still do it to this day. You know, my kids are in their 30s. My youngest is 28. And if you take your cell phone out during a meal, you have to pay for the meal. You have to pay for your own meal.
Yes.
And so my kids, you know, you can see them peeking down like my daughter's in their purses like, well, you know. So I'm like, hey, man, pull your phone out. You're paying for your own meal. We're going to get separate bill here. I got everybody. And they know Dad's going to pay for everything, right? I got everybody but that one. That one's on their own. And so, I mean, nobody pulls their phone out, but you get to see everybody going, oh, my gosh, I got to get to my phone. So one of the things I love to say to my kids when they do kind of pull their phone out and we're all together, like we're sitting in watching a movie or whatever and somebody's on their phone, you know, that, you know, I always say, you know, we've never been more connected through technology and less connected as people. We're always like walking around the airports like this all the time. Right.
Yeah.
And so my youngest daughter, especially, she's always on the phone and she's kind of a, you know, she's kind of a social media influencer and she does all that stuff. So she's always on her phone. And I'm like, one of the things I say to her, like constantly, and she always starts to laugh is, hey, what are people you don't know doing right now? I go, what are people you don't know doing right now? Like, it's really important. Like, I mean, instead of connecting with me and with the rest of the family, you know, you're connecting with people you don't know. So it's important to know what they're doing right now, right? And you're just like, when you think about it at that level, how stupid are we, right? How dumb are we for getting so involved in that And listen, man, I'm guilty. I am completely 100% guilty. But I just think it's funny. You know, I just think it's interesting. Kind of we've gotten to the point where we care more about what people think of us that we have no clue we'll probably never meet than we care about, you know, connecting with the people who are right in front of us. It's insane, but it is kind of where we are right now.
Well said. And I think I hear, like, when people listen to this or watching this, they're going to be applauding you because you just gave them the ultimate line for being like, who do you not even know is, you know, what are they doing right now? That is perfect. I love it.
What are people you don't know doing right now? This is really interesting. It's insane, but it is. And I'll be the first to jump on that sword. I'm guilty.
Nice. Two more questions before we get into football and just sports commentating, all that good stuff. For you, let's kind of flip the script. And I think you kind of shared something that you learned from your family. You know, you said your parents were great and they were there for you and all that other stuff, but you wanted to kind of change the dynamic and have a meal together, right?
Right.
Now let me flip the script on that, on you, in the sense of what is something that your kids have taught you about life or yourself in general that you'd like to share?
I mean, they teach you so much. Just like one of the things that I think that your kids need, and, you know, just learn this being a parent, is they need more than anything for you to believe in them, right? And they need that support and they need that encouragement and they need that. Like, to me, I was always big on, I don't care what you do. I just care who you become, right? And I'm here to help you try to become the best, you know, that you can be. And so, you know, really, I just have always believed that the best thing we can do as parents is to believe in them, right? And to give them those opportunities and just to be there to support them. And so anyhow, that was kind of one of the things that as life goes on and as you grow those kids up, that, you know, I used to say it all the time. As a matter of fact, Coach Mike Vrabel said, I used to say this to my son, like in my daughters, when they were playing soccer, I was like, I can't wait to watch you play. When my son trotted out the first time in a major league game,
yeah,
it's the greatest sports moment of my life. And, you know, and I was introduced in three Super Bowls and got to play. And I consider those rings garbage. It's just, they don't even matter compared to watching your own flesh and blood get to pitch in a major league game, you know, called out of the bullpen. As a matter of fact, we go out as a family. I got a call from the GM. And the GM says, hey, he's not going to pitch tomorrow, but we're calling him up. And then, you know, Daniel calls me and says, hey, man, I just got called up. And, you know, I burst out into tears because I have emotional incontinence. I can't even watch a Disney movie without crying. So that's just the way I'm wired.
Yeah.
And so anyhow, I burst out into tears, you know, and it's a celebration. And so that's like it, because he was pitching in Mobile, Alabama. So I don't know if that was, I think it's Eastern time, Central or Eastern time, but, you know, the game gets over. It's, you know, 11 o'clock there. It's 10 o'clock or whatever, 9 o'clock here. So now we're scrambling for tickets because, you know, my one daughter lives here. My other daughter lives in California. My wife and I live in Denver, you know, and so we're scrambling to get tickets to get there. Well, you know, we show up to, it's Arizona. We show up to Phoenix and I'm like, no sweat. He's not going to pitch today. The GM already called. And so, you know, we're checking in and, you know, doing our thing. And I get a call and it's Daniel. He goes, where are you? And I'm like, oh, we're checking in the hotel. You want to get some lunch? He goes, no, get over here. I'm dressed. I'm throwing today. And instantly, I mean, I instantly had diarrhea. I was like, oh, God, you know, get you. Like, oh, put everything in the room or just store it. We'll be back. And so we run over there and we go through the whole, you know, family section, right? And we get down to the stadium. We get down to BP, you know, to the field level. And he walks out of the dugout. And I kid you not, I can't be consoled. I am bawling like I was, you know, a 5-year-old that just got, you know, I mean, whatever, just had, you know, got a boo-boo, right?
Yeah.
And I can't stop crying. I mean, I am bawling to the point where my son is like, it's going to be okay, Dad. Like, he's hugging on me, right? Everybody's hugging. And I got all these families like, oh, look how sweet. They're taking pictures and stuff, you know. And I can't be consoled. I just am, like, it's so emotional. And then to see him come out in the sixth inning and throw a scoreless six, I'll never forget. It's the greatest sports memory in my life.
I love that. And thank you very much for sharing that. I think I remember you kind of talking about that on one of the, you know, morning shows and all that. But one of the things too, I feel like for you being a pro athlete, knowing everything that it takes to get there, right? Because everyone feels like, oh, you know, they know how hard, I mean, fans know how hard it is to get there, but right. But then for you, it's like, you're a professional athlete. Then your son's trying to get into another professional program in baseball in the MLB. You see all the blood, sweat, and tears he put in there. So you, not just because he's your son, but because you can relate to him about all the things that took to get there, right? So, I mean, all those emotions just probably just got to you, right?
Right. But without question. I think the other thing is, we tend as just humans, we see the money that's out there. You know, we see a lot of the ancillary benefits that come with playing a professional sport. And for us as fans, it dehumanizes the athlete, right? You're no longer human. You no longer have the right to have emotions. You no longer have the right to be, you know, upset or angry or hurt or whatever. And, you know, I see the other side of it. I know what it feels like to be disappointed. I know what it feels like to play a game where you get your ass kicked and you let your teammates down, you know, and I've been there. And so I know what it's like to be hurt. I know what it's like to be injured. I know the frustration. And so all those things, you know, you go through that, that whole litany of emotion as you see, you know, your kid going on that same journey that you've been on. And so it's just really, you know, it's really a kind of a, it's a fun and awesome journey. But it's hard, you know, it's emotionally difficult and physically it's difficult even to this day. For me, you know, I get to July and I feel like, uh-oh, summer's over. Like I haven't been to camp, training camp in, shoot, this is 20 years for me. And I still have a knot in my stomach over like, uh-oh, like life as you know it is over. Right now, it's just going to be this arduous mental and physical task of going through a season. So I still have, you know, I still have the butterflies in my gut and nobody's going to hit me. I mean, I'm going to be fine, you know? So, but it's still one of those things that's just kind of ingrained in your thought process.
Yeah. And I agree with you too. Like the idea of like, oh, this person's making so much money and, you know, to play sports and all this other stuff. Like the idea that like someone who works at a bank or this or that, or whatever profession, you don't know their salary. So again, like you don't see them as like, oh, but they shouldn't be complaining because they're making this much money. To me, for the life of me, I always think it's funny where it's like, they're letting you know what an athlete makes, right? Like to me, right. It takes the humanity out of it. Like, what does it matter if he got benched or what does it matter if he lost a game? He's going to be going to a match. And it's like,
right. Yeah. And that's the thing is you're a competitor. You didn't get to that level by having the attitude of, oh, it doesn't matter to me. I'm making a lot of money. Like you're not playing, you know, ultimately you're playing because it's, you know, like there's a song, I'm a big 80s freak, you know, and there was the line from a song by The Alarm that says, it's the lifeblood that courses through my veins, right? And so I've always thought about that as football, this love-hate relationship I've had with it my entire life, but it's been the lifeblood that courses through my veins. And, you know, my dad told me when I was a little boy, find something you love to do and you'll never have to go to work. And shoot, I'm 55 years old and you know, I got to play professional football my entire, you know, young adult life. And I got to talk about it the rest of my adult life. Like, it's been really good. You know, it's been really good. And it doesn't mean I haven't worked hard and haven't had disappointments and haven't, you know, had 29 surgeries and haven't, you know, got bypassed for jobs and, you know, not got, you know, voted out of whatever, but, it's been, you know, it's been a great journey and I love it. And, you know, when I hear people say about, oh, well, the football field or the baseball diamond, it's a safe haven. You can get away from your problems. No, you can't. But if you got issues, you got issues. You know, I don't care if you're going to the bank or you're going to the stadium. I mean, it's hard to play that way. So that's just kind of my personal take on playing a professional sport. And the bottom line is you're allowed to have emotions and you're allowed to be human as far as I'm concerned.
No doubt. One more question. And I think a lot of things you said, a lot of people can take as, you know, for new parents listening to this and be like, oh, that's great. That's great. And a lot of things you're throwing out there that people can kind of put into their parenting Rolodex, right? I always love asking this question for new dads listening to this, new parents, what is one big piece of advice you'd offer to them?
be involved. You know, I mentioned the quantity time aspect of it, you know, the quality versus quantity time. And, you know, I always said it, like, anytime I set an hour aside to spend some quality of my kid or quality time with my kids, they did something to piss me off. And it's the quantity time, because within that quantity, there are going to be slivers of quality. There are going to be times when you connect. There are going to be those moments, those aha moments where you guys both connect, you know? And I just think that's kind of like the biggest thing is just to be there, right? Just to be present. And, you know, it's interesting. I always kind of talk a lot of times when I'm out speaking, I talk about having, you know, looking at life through a different lens, and I call it my God's eye lens, you know, from 30,000 feet.
Yeah.
And in 1993, I had a autoimmune issue called Guillain-Barré syndrome. And I lost all the feeling in my arms and legs for about 4 or 5 months, 6 months. I was really, really sick. And it was, you know, my career was essentially over. And, you know, there were a lot of people who just said, you just not never gonna play again, right? And I went from 295 to 235. And like just going up and down the stairs one flight, I'd have to take a 2-hour nap. And again, like I had no, like literally no feeling from about my knees down and my elbows down. And that's, that happened within a week's time. I went from tingling in my fingers and tingling in my toes to no feeling at all. And so the only thing I could do really to be involved in my kids' lives was make lunches. And so I'd get up every morning and I would go down and I would pack the greatest lunch. yes. I literally thought I invented aerosol cheese. I'm like, you can put this aerosol, like you can put it on crackers. You can put it in, like, I was like, does anybody know this exists other than me? I'm like, I'm making celery sticks with aerosol cheese. You know, I'm just doing, like, I'm making the greatest lunches. And then one day I decided, hey man, I'm going to start writing notes in my daughter's and my son's napkins. And I started doing that. They were probably, this is 1993. So they were probably like in first and second grade or something. My youngest was not born yet. She was on her way to be born.
Yeah.
And my wife is pregnant. So this is what I did every day. And it went on through all my kids' grade school, all their junior high school, all their high school. And, you know, it became an event every day at the lunch table. What did your dad write in the napkin? And sometimes it would just be inspirational stuff. A lot of times it would just be stupid, right? It would just be stupid stuff. You know, dad stuff, right? Dad jokes and things like that, right? And, you know, and it became this cool thing. So my youngest daughter lives in LA now, and we were cleaning, we're going to repaint some of the house. So we were taking stuff off of her walls, you know, going to repaint. And I look on it, she's got a cork board up there, and I look on the cork board and there's a note from one of her lunch boxes. And it was just, it touched me, right? Like this is a connective piece that we have. And at the time I was like, oh, woe is me. I'm sick. Something's wrong. I have no idea what it is. You know, I have this big, beautiful home that I'm gonna have to sell because I haven't made enough money to support it. And my career could be over. And you look at all those things that, you know, that you can look at it yourself and feel sorry for yourself, or you can continue to live, right? And I look at that connection. Now, my son threw them all away. He didn't give a crap. Right? But my daughters in their scrapbooks, they have a bunch of these napkins that meant something to them at the time that they all saved, you know? Yeah. And again, you can look at, I look at that time now through kind of that God's eye lens. And I'm like, wow, what a blessed time. And that created a lifetime of memories for my kids and a lifetime of connection through disappointment and through, you know, a tragic event in my life. And it was, I mean, I was really sick, like really sick. And anyhow, to have that be the outcome, and to go on and play another 7 years, you know, and to continue that kind of quote unquote tradition with my kids, yeah, it's just kind of amazing. Now, when I was playing, I didn't do it during the regular season, but in the off season, man, I was up making sandwiches and making lunches. So You know, just a really cool opportunity to connect. And again, it just goes back to being involved.
And it, well said. And just the idea of having that note being how she kept that. And it just, you know, that's something that it's the smallest things that sometimes create the biggest impact, right?
Right.
As a parent, and like just you writing those notes and like the idea of like their friends being like, what do you write today, right? It's right. It was just awesome. Yeah. So I love it.
Well, I did, you know, it's interesting. Like I have a standing date with my granddaughter on my 8-year-old granddaughter on Mondays and Wednesdays. I take her to Taekwondo.
Nice.
And it's, you know, I pick her up. I always have, you know, she's always like quietly, secretly, we got like, I sneak her treats. So she always checks my pocket to see what kind of candy she's getting, right? What kind of treat she's getting. And so there's this, it's like a date for the two of us. And we get to drive over 15 minutes and I watch her do her Taekwondo. And then I drive her back home. And we live in the same neighborhood. She lives 10 doors down from me. So it's nice. It's awesome. But I have her convinced that that I invented Cobra Kai and Miyagi-Don karate. And she like legitimately is like, Popo was a Cobra Kai back in, you know, and she thinks that I'm like, it, she has no idea what Cobra Kai is. She thinks I invented it. And I'll have to, at some point, I'll be honest with her and tell her the truth. But she just thinks that I am a karate master.
Love and, it.
Eventually I'll tell her the truth, but right now I'm having too much fun with it.
This is
She actually got me a Cobra Kai t-shirt. So she saw it and she's like at the mall and she's like, oh my gosh. She goes, we have to get that for Popo. He invented Cobra Kai, you know? And so my son and my daughter-in-law got me this beautiful Cobra Kai t-shirt. It's awesome.
Just seeing like the twinkle in your eyes talking about your granddaughter is fantastic, man. Thank you very much for sharing your father journey. We're going to, of course, at the end, close out with the father quick five, but want to talk to you about, you know, your career and all that good stuff from, you know, your college days to the pro level. What was like the biggest transition for you? Like what was maybe the biggest hurdle or something you were just like, I mean, I obviously going into the NFL, you know, things are going to be getting more intense and all that stuff. But for you, what was like the biggest hurdle or the biggest transition?
Well, really, you know, I was injured my whole college career. And so, you know, again, that lens with which you look through life. I came in as an offensive lineman, but was athletically gifted and they moved me to defense. So I played defense for 3 years and I just kept getting hurt to the point where they retired me from college. And so I was literally retired from college football as a junior. And begged the university to let me play again, the University of Idaho, and essentially signed papers to limit their liability towards me as an injury risk to let me play my last year, and then moved over to a position that I haven't played, which was guard. And so I effectively played 1 year of college football. And I had nothing, right? No interest, no agent, no nothing. And you know, it's amazing. One of the things I love about football in general, just that the importance of team, right? And bonding together. It's like family. And being for one another. And I had a teammate by the name of Marvin Washington, who was a college basketball player, and the college basketball program got canceled at UTEP, University of Texas, El Paso. So he transferred to Idaho. And he was working out in the summertime doing some summer school classes. And the football coaching staff, you know, he's 6'6 and 265. They're like, hey, you're more athletically gifted than anybody we have on our team. Do you want to play, you know? And so he came out and played and ended up getting 14 sacks. And so he was this highly kind of coveted prospect. And, you know, he knew my childhood dream since I was 12 was to play in the NFL. And so one night he called me, you know, again, I had no agent, I had no interest, I had no nothing. And he said, hey, listen, such and such team is showing up tomorrow morning at 7:00. He goes, just crash my workout, see what happens. Beg them to, you know, beg the scouts. So I showed up, I introduced myself, I begged them to let me work out. And, you know, the crazy thing was, is again, even with 6 knee surgeries and an elbow surgery and all the issues that I had health-wise, I made it through my last year, you know, healthy, and I played really well, and I could run and jump, and I blew Marvin away in every bench press, 40s, you know, eye test, shuttle test, vertical jump. I crushed him in everything, right? I mean, I probably cost him. He was supposed to be a second or third rounder. He ended up getting drafted by the Jets in the sixth round. I cost him three to four rounds in the draft for working out with me. But he called me probably 15 times to invite me to his workouts. And I crushed him in every one of his workouts. And if it wasn't for Marvin Washington, my college teammate, I would have played in the NFL. I had no chance. And, you know, interestingly enough, they came and they started coming to work me out, right? And that's how I ended up getting drafted and playing. And Marvin ended up playing for 11 years in the league, and I ended up playing for 12. But here's the coolest part of that story, is I wouldn't have played had it not been for Marvin Washington. After we won the Super Bowl in Denver, Super Bowl 32 against the Green Bay Packers, I'm sitting in the training room where I spent the majority of my career rehabbing injuries. And Mike Shanahan comes down, our head coach, with a list of names. And he said, hey, man, I want you to go through this list of names for me. He goes, we need a swing guy, a guy that can play D-tackle, defensive end. But most importantly, we need a guy that fits the personality of our football team, that cares, that's willing to sacrifice, that's willing to, you know, to do the dirty work type of thing. And he goes, I got seven, eight names, whatever it was, on this list of paper. You can check it out. And he goes, tell me who you think best fits our team, and that's who I'll kind of go after. So he hands me this slip of paper, and the first name I see in the middle of the thing, my eyes just naturally draw to, it's Marvin Washington. Yeah. So I go, sign him. So he goes, okay, done. So he goes out and he signs Marvin Washington, and Marvin Washington and I won a Super Bowl together as members of the Denver Broncos. So yes. Really cool. That I wouldn't have played without him, and he wouldn't have had a chance to win a championship. He was injured too at the time. So he was rehabbing a torn quad and probably wouldn't have been signed based on the injury. But Mike accepted the fact that I said, this is your guy, this guy will fit. And really cool that we had that opportunity to be together. You know, we're still tight. And,
How is this not a movie by then, right?
Well, because I played offensive line, nobody really cares. but yeah, it was really awesome. And then, you know, you get into the league, you know, and it's funny, you know, I got into the league and you know, at first you're watching guys you watched on Sundays, right? And there's times when you're like, oh Lord, I don't belong here, right? Like, these guys are just built different. But my whole process going into it was, if I don't make the team, it's not because I'm going to talk myself out of it or lack of effort. It's because I'm not good enough. And I can live with not being good enough, right? I mean, there's only 1,500 people in the world that are good enough to play in the NFL. So, you know, there's no shame in not being good enough. Yeah. We're all blessed by the hand of God with different talents, right? And so I was just like, but it isn't going to be, it's not, it's, that's the only thing that's going to get me kicked out of this. And then, you know, you play and you realize, oh shoot, I'm as strong as anybody and I'm as athletically gifted as anybody. And you start to build some confidence, you know, and you know, one thing leads to another, and you make a team, and then you end up starting for 12 years, you know? So, yeah. But again, it was really about not talking myself out of it, because I could easily, there were many times I started talking myself out of it, and I said, whoa, snap back in now. Told you're not going to do this, right? You know, and you literally had to talk to yourself, or at least I did. I was like, whoa, you're going to compete, man. So anyhow, that's kind of how it went.
Love it, man. And again, like, just the idea, like, I you're right. Like, no one really talks about the offensive line because maybe it's not as sexy as a quarterback, wide receiver, whatever the case may be. But they will start talking about you if the, you know, the quarterback is started getting sacks, or the, you know, the guys aren't opening up holes. So it's always funny. Like, it's like refs and offensive line and, like, you know, tackles, guards, and centers. You don't want to be talked about, because when you're talked about, it's not usually good, right?
Right. Absolutely. And, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, you know, I always think it's fascinating to me. Like, you know, that position, like, I always told my daughters, find an offensive line They're loyal. They sacrifice for the good of the team. They don't want any of the fanfare, right? I mean, you need to find yourself an offensive line. So we're a little bit chubby. That's okay. but it's that loyalty. It's that self-sacrifice. It's that, you know, that you're not going to be self-aggrandizing. You know, you're not out there looking for attention. You want to do your job to the best of your ability. You want to sacrifice for one another. I mean, you can have a collection of five average athletes, but if those five average athletes are working in unison together, they're going to be pretty good. And, you know, you think about the position. I mean, like we are the last rung on the ladder. Like you think about, I've seen corners transition to safety, safety transition to linebacker, linebacker to DN, DN to D-tackle, D-tackle to offensive lineman. The transition from offensive lineman is the fan. Like there's nowhere else to go. And think about this, because this is really interesting. I think it's the most skilled position in football. But think about this. Tell me one other sport where unlike athletes are matched up and the lesser of the two athletes is expected to win every time. And if he doesn't win every time, he sucks and the other guy goes to the Pro Bowl.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. Like if you get switched up in the NBA, you get caught on a switch and a 6'3" point guard is lined up against a 7-foot center and that guy dunks on him. You don't go, this point guard can't play a lick of defense. Get rid of the guy.
Yeah.
But you know, you got a 200 or 320 pound tackle that gets spin moved by 255 pound Dwight Freeney, who runs a 4.46, you know, and all of a sudden you suck and Dwight goes to the Pro Bowl. Now Dwight's a great player, but you know what I'm saying? Like it's, you're the same size and strength ratio, but that guy's exponentially a better athlete than you. And if you don't block him 65 times in a row, you suck. And like, that's the game that you play up front. So that's why I'm always like, it's the greatest skill position in all of football. And I just wish all of you other people would recognize that. But nobody will.
And you're starting at a disadvantage too, because they can line up. They don't have to be in a 3-point stance and all other stuff, right?
Yeah.
So all those things, man. Two more questions before we go. Actually, one more question about football, and then we're going to get into broadcasting. And then, of course, I got to ask about acting as well.
Okay.
Big football fan. Like my family grew up in Buffalo, so my mom, God rest her soul, my sisters, they're Bills fans. My dad, I was the only one born outside of Buffalo. I was born in South Bend when Joe Montana was playing, right?
Okay.
So he and I became Niners fans. But I remember I just have a love for football. And I remember when you guys played the Packers and the Broncos for the first Super Bowl, I remember at my work at a grocery store, we all did like 12 of us got into a bag and we had to take our names out, our team's names out. And I got the Broncos right before when the playoffs started. And you put in like $10 or $20, whatever the case may be. And so the front end manager, Roy, he had the Green Bay Packers and it was the Packers and I had the Broncos. He goes up to me, he's like, you know, the Packers are going to win, right? The Broncos never win a Super Bowl.
Right.
And he's like, just, you know what? I'll give you more money right now. If we, like, I'll just concede that they're going to win. And I'm like, no, man, I feel like they have something to prove. He's like, fine. You're going to lose anyways. I'm like, all right, fine. You guys won. It wasn't like you're like, oh, Art said he's, you know, going to win some money. But right. The idea, like everybody was, you know, the Packers were favorite. Everyone's like, the Broncos can never win the Super Bowl. The reason why I bring that story up about my side of it is because I felt like, yeah, you guys had a lot of great people on your team, but it was always like, Broncos can't do it in the Super Bowl. What was your mindset? Maybe just you can talk about your team's mindset or just you going into that game being like, of course you have the idea that you're going to win, but did you have anything creep into you being like, are we going to be able to beat these Packers, the Broncos? We don't have the best track record. What were your thoughts going into that game?
Yeah, I think that, you know, you look at the past history, it has nothing to do with the guys that are on the team now, right? And we had a bunch of guys from, you know, from different teams, right? And we knew the history of Elway, but we also knew how good we were. And I think one of the things for us, you know, there's always that certain amount of disrespect because I think we opened up the week at 13 and a half point underdogs. And we kicked off at like 11 and a half point underdogs. And I think a big part of that was we had played them in December the year before, and we had locked up the playoffs. We had locked everything up. So I had just had knee surgery the week before I played. Gary Zimmerman had shoulder surgery. He didn't play, was our starting offensive left tackle, all pro. Terrell Davis didn't play. John Elway didn't play. We have like four guys on defense that didn't play. and they throttled us. It was like a, you know, a cold December day in Green Bay, and they beat us like 42-7 or whatever. And it was interesting because there was definitely that week of the you know, we were in the San Diego Chargers facility in San Diego there, that week of the Super Bowl, there was definitely this feeling of, these guys have no clue who we are. Like, they're looking at that game like that's endemic of what we are, and it's not at all who we were, right? I mean, we had things locked up, and we didn't play half our team. They played our JV team. And so, you know, there was a level of disrespect there that was bothersome. You know, we had the smallest offensive line in the league. They had the biggest defensive line in the league. And we're like, it doesn't matter. We're the smallest every week. And we still run it down everybody's throat. Like we're committed to it. We know what we're doing. And it has that, like, leverage, being able to create leverage is technique. It doesn't have anything to do with size. It has to do with everything with technique and the way you come off the ball. So we're just like, these guys don't have a clue what they're about ready to get into, right? And so that was our attitude. And our week of practice when we got to San Diego was like what was normally an hour and 45 minute practice. We were off the field in, you know, in an hour and 15 without a ball touching the ground. I mean, there was not a mistake. There wasn't a repeat. It was one after the other. So you had this great confidence. And the other thing was Mike Shanahan, who should be in the Hall of Fame, because most of the West Coast offense that we see today was really, you know, you talk about the Saints, you talk about Green Bay, you talk about, you know, about Sean McVay with the Rams, you talk all these, Kyle Shanahan in San Francisco, the root of all that started with Mike Shanahan is he took Bill Walsh's offense and morphed it. And so now that's kind of the root of what's going on in the NFL right now. And he showed us a film of this is why we're going to gut these guys in the running game. So, all right. So we're in San Diego. He's like, okay, let's watch it. So he's like, look at this formation. And we got into like strong right, which is tight end on the right side, fullback, on the right side, short, tailback back, you know, right behind the quarterback. Strong right slot, so the Z receiver's in the middle and the X receiver, so it was Eddie McCaffrey in the middle and Ron Smith. Every time you got into that formation, the Green Bay Packers adjusted. Their outside, weak side linebacker, a guy by the name of Brian Williams, would basically get 2x2 or 3x3. So he essentially would move out to take away any slants from the Z receiver. And Leroy Butler, great safety for the Green Bay Packers, come flying down. And so they were basically exchanging responsibility. So the weak side linebacker, the Will, became the safety, and the safety became the Will linebacker. And so we just turned the Will loose to our Z receiver and said, go hunt him up. And so anytime we had that look, the backside would scoop to the safety. And Mike Shanahan showed probably one night, it had to be 30 minutes of cutups against every team, that every time they got in that formation, the guard or whoever was responsible for the weak side linebacker would be chasing some guy that wasn't in play, and Leroy Butler would make the tackle in the backfield like 100% of the time. And so we like, if they do this, we're going to kill them. Sure enough, the very first play, we're running 18 handoff. And so I'm on the backside, and I can see, you know, I see the weak side linebacker move out, and I'm, you know, looking through the top of my helmet, and I can see here comes Leroy, and I just gave him a mouthful of Rydell, wham, you know, and here comes TD 15 yards, right? And you're like, oh my, we are going to gut these guys. Like, we're going to gut them. I was telling Brett Favre that story just during the football season. I bumped into him, he came up to the booth, and we cut something. He goes, Brett goes, did we ever adjust? I said, nope, you guys never adjusted. And we absolutely, I mean, TD missed a quarter. Terrell Davis missed a quarter and still had 152 yards rushing. Missed a quarter with a migraine.
Yeah.
So, you know, you just had that confidence. And Shanahan did that stuff all the time. Shanahan said, hey, listen, when we get to this, is what they're going to be in, and we're going to get them with this. And he'd be like, oh, here it comes, here it comes. You could hear him on the sideline. Here it comes, we got him. And sure enough, Like, I mean, it happened all the time. He was, and Kyle does the same thing. And I talked to Kyle about it. I go, how'd you, because I held my dad's cord for however many years. Like he would do it all the time. So now it's like, I've inherited it. You know, it's become part of, as a matter of fact, Kyle Shanahan was the last person in a Super Bowl to hold the cord of the head coach. Because they went wireless after Super Bowl 30. Yeah, after Super Bowl, it was either 32 or 33. They went wireless. So Kyle is the last guy to ever hold the head coach's cord during the course of a Super Bowl. There's a little trivia question for you.
Okay, so you broke down parenting really well. Talking about your transition and talking about the Super Bowl really well. So this bleeds into my next question. I mean,
right.
You do such a fantastic job breaking down, you know, the NFL on Fox's, you know, color commentator and all that. You have your own show on Denver, you know, 104.3 The Fan with Mike Evans and all that. So just hearing this, maybe haven't heard you, maybe living under a rock and haven't, you know, heard you talk about football before. You know the basics, you know the X's and O's. What was the transition like for you from, you know, playing to actually commentating? What was like maybe the biggest hiccup? Because it sounds like you know exactly what you're doing, but like what was like the transition from the, you know, actual on the field to like calling the games on the field?
Well, you know, it's funny because I spent 16 years at ESPN as a studio analyst. And as a studio analyst, can you articulate? And I think the biggest thing is you learn. Because when you first get into it, you know, you're kind of scripting out your comments. I want to say this, and I want to say this. And I figured out pretty quickly that once I get off track, I'm just stumbling around like, And so I was like, I am no longer going to script out any comments. I'll put down one word, you know, that I want to get to, whatever, right? And that's it. And then ultimately, just to be able to listen, right? Listen to the other analysts and be able to shift. Like, I've done the work. I mean, I watched every play of every game for over a decade. And so like, there's nothing you can throw at me in studio that I'm not familiar with, that I haven't seen to some degree. Right. And so I was always very conscientious about not only doing the work, I've got an offensive lineman's mentality when it comes to doing the work, I'm going to do the work, but I was also always wanted to listen because, hey, the comment I might be thinking about saying, if you say something that's more interesting, I'll just scrap out what I was going to say and I'll jump on that. And so listening becomes, because I think a lot of young analysts or young television personalities, they don't listen. Like, they've got in their mind what they're going to talk about. And heck, if you say something that's more interesting, then, you know, I want to be able to transition and talk about what you're saying. So I was always very conscientious about that.
The offensive lineman mentality, right? Work together as a team, right there.
Right, exactly. And then ultimately, when I went into doing games, it is like I realized how much, like, so I always tell people, you know, when you're an analyst, you kind of look at the game through a straw hole, right? You're kind of just looking at your position, right? And it's really easy to focus in on that. And you got to increase your aperture. And you've got to see the game in totality. And I realized, we all do as players, you tend to focus on what you know the best, right? Because that's the easiest thing to focus on. And so I started calling games and I'm like, first off, there's so much eye candy going on. There's so much stuff. Like, you got the field right there, you got medic, you got multiple monitors. You're like, and you lose focus, you lose track of like down and distance situation and where we are on the field and, you know, and all these different things. There's just so much stuff coming at you and it's coming at you so fast and you no longer have 30 seconds to a minute to kind of chop it up, man. You got to get in and out in 18 seconds, you know? And so what I ended up doing is I realized, wow, I've got to look at the game through the eyes of a coach. And so what I started doing is just building relationships. And I'm a big relational person. You know, I'm a big team guy. Like, I always tell people, what's the first thing that Jesus did when he got his ministry together at age 33 or whatever? He got 12 guys together, right? Like, hey, man, I need my guy. Let's go change the world. And I need 12 of you to do it with me, right?
Yeah.
Like, that to me is important. What's one of the reasons I love being part of a team? I love it. I love that sacrifice. I love that connectivity. I love being together. So That was always a big thing for me. So I just really developed relationships with coaches and GMs I could trust. My relationship with Mike Shanahan has been, it's so cool to watch the transition from coach player to coach media guy to media guy mentor to just friends.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so like I go over to Mike's house and, you know, and I'll just be like, all right, here's my question. Why this, you know? And he'll put on film and we'll sit there for hours going over. Like one day we went over this concept called branch in a West Coast offense, which is a like an 8 yard out to stick route. Stick route's 6 yards, branch is at 8 yards with a go on the outside. And I kid you not, we watched that concept branch for 2 hours. Like cut ups, 2 hours. And I'm like, that's a branch again. there it is again. And you know, and he just like he can just watch, he can sit for 6 hours without ever taking a pee break and watch film. Like he's a camel. But he directs me in like, hey man, you need to think about this or go after this. And now what's ended up happening is, you know, I consult for several teams in the NFL and it's so funny because I had a team on a Zoom call the other day and they're like, well, we want to get better at running the ball. And I'm like, yeah, hey, you know, excuse my French, but no shit. Like, really? Yeah. Like everybody says it, but nobody really wants to make the commitment, right? It's like, that's the same as saying, hey man, I want to lose some weight. Yeah, really? You know, there is no magic pill. You want to lose some weight? You actually have to do the work, right?
Yeah.
I got this crazy idea. If you burn more calories than you consume, guess what? You'll actually lose weight. But nobody wants to make that commitment, right?
Yep.
And so I'm like, you know what drives me crazy? I'm talking to a head coach and he's a play caller. And I'm like, you know what drives me crazy? Like, first off, you got to have permission to speak honestly, right? We're good like that, right? And so, yeah. I go, you know what drives me crazy about you? And he's like, yeah, like, here we go. What? I go, you'll call a run 3 times in a row, right? And I go, and you'll net 2 yards per carry. And you'll throw your arms up and say, ah, screw it, we can't run the ball. But I go, you'll throw 7 incompletions in a row and you'll keep chucking it. What's wrong with you? Like, and he just is laughing. He goes, okay, I'm guilty. Like, raise my hand, I'm guilty. So it's one of those things where how committed are you? It's just like parenting, man. How committed are you going to be? You know, how selfless are you going to be? How much are you going to be involved? And so, you know, in today's day and age, it's funny because the whole league has come into this, you know, oh, got to have the quarterback, got to pass the ball, got to do all this. Yeah, I'll tell you what, last year in the playoffs, show me the team that won the line of scrimmage. I'll show you the team that won 100% of playoff games.
Yep.
100% of playoff games.
No, oh, man. I could talk to you for hours and hours of football. I appreciate it. Before we get into the Fatherhood Quick Five, sir, Guiding Light, Ballers, acting, what inspired you to do that?
I got asked to do it, and I was like, yeah, whatever. You know, hey, listen, man, I'm glad I don't have to pay my bills through my acting career, right? I get these residual checks, and they're hilarious. They're like 2 cents, 3 cents. I'm like, why do you even send this to me, right? I bet you in the last 2 years, I've had probably a dozen checks for no money. They send me a check, it's 000. That's my residual. I actually have a check on the counter right now for like $40. And it's because the movie Red Dawn, the remake of Red Dawn, is on it's on like Xfinity pay-per-view, right? So like, you know, I mean, people are actually, I apologize. If you watched it, I'm sorry. I was great for 2.5 minutes. I was awesome. After, like, you watch the open, and I'm on the open, and then you can just pretty much shut it off after that. It's not the one with Swayze and all those guys. Yeah. It is, but I will tell you something funny. It was before Chris Hemsworth was, like, a big superstar, like, before he was Thor, right? And so he literally had signed to do this movie. And between signing to do the movie and shooting the movie, he had inked a deal, his agent inked a deal to be Thor. So he was about to be a big deal, but at that time, he was just a guy, right?
Yeah.
And so we're sitting, because we filmed, we're in Troy, Michigan, and we filmed all the football scenes. We'd start filming at like midnight. So we'd film all through the night and then everybody go home and sleep, right, during the day. And so we're, you know, the best thing about shooting a movie, any movie, is crafty services, right? Because the crafty services people are like, they always got all kinds of little goodies out, you know, and food out and goodies. And you're just over there, just like a squirrel, you know, eating stuff. And so Hemsworth, we're talking and he's like, hey, man, I got this deal with Thor and I got to put on some weight. And so now he's asking me about how to get in shape. And I don't know if you've seen any pictures of it lately, but he is just absolutely dope, yep. Right?
Like, Hulk Hogan was talking about his arms, his forearms with him.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, he's absolutely yoked. So I like to take credit for his transformation. Like he would have never, he'd been skinny Hulk or skinny Thor if it wasn't for me. So you're welcome, America.
Ties it all together. Nice.
Yeah,
one of the most important people in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is Mark Schlereth. I love it.
Right, exactly.
And speaking of movies, let's go transition right into the Fatherhood Quick Five. You've been so gracious with your time, so thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Favorite family movie right now you guys like to watch together, or maybe because you know your kids are all grown up, maybe you can say a holiday movie, or favorite movie you like to watch with your granddaughter. What is it?
Oh, my granddaughter is Kung Fu Panda. So my youngest granddaughter, she's 4, and she acts out. I'd love to put one of those Fitbit things on her or. What is it? What do you call a thing that tracks your steps?
Yeah, Fitbit. Yeah.
Yeah, she acts out the entire movie. Like she's over there doing karate, and she plays a character the whole time. So we love watching that together. So that is, we love that one. And then my wife and I have probably watched Jumanji, no joke, with The Rock. I bet you we watched it 25 times during the pandemic. And I only, here's the thing that's interesting about me is I only want to watch movies I've watched before, because if I lay my head down on the floor of my study, I'll fall asleep. Like, so like it drives my wife crazy because she's like, let's watch a movie again. Okay. And I want to watch something I've watched so I can fall asleep and I'll be sleeping for 20 minutes. I'll wake up and I go, oh my gosh, I love this part. Right. And I'm like totally locked in. I'm like, oh, this is great. And, you know, like right after the part. So that's how I operate. And so we've watched during the pandemic, it drives her crazy because I'll just put it on. And I know instantly within 4 or 5 minutes, I'll be asleep and I'll wake up at some point, watch a little bit, and then I'll fall back asleep. And so, you know, that's one movie we've watched a ton.
Love it. You said music, 80s music was big for you. So was there an artist or a band you couldn't wait to introduce your kids to when they got to a certain age to appreciate it?
Yeah, all anything 80s alternative. So whether it's like The Cure, The Smiths, nice. You know, I love all that kind of music. I love Echo and the Bunnymen,
nice.
The Waterboys. You know, if I went through my list, you'd just be like, dude, you're a weirdo, right? Brian Ferry. Nice. You know, I mean, these are the things that I just really dug. Dream Academy. I'm going through it. Jane's Addiction. Natalie Merchant. 10,000 Maniacs. Peter Murphy. REM. The Replacements. Love The Replacements. Roxy Music. Love Roxy Music. Susie and the Banshees. You know, Talk, U2, obviously. How do you not love U2? XTC, one of the great songs, The Mayor of Simpleton. I relate to that song a lot. So, yeah, those are my jams, and they will be for the rest of my life.
Nice. Describe the perfect family vacation. Where would it be?
We like to go to Hawaii, but we'd love to go back to Alaska. My wife and I are both from Alaska, and we don't get up there enough. We try to get up during the summer times, but life is just so busy. But we love going up, seeing our families. And we got a couple of little fishing spots where we, you know, max out every time we go out there. So silver salmon season is huge. And we'd love to go up there and just slay silvers and then smoke silvers and all that kind of stuff. So, all of us together, Alaska, and all of us fishing in some, you know, with waders on and just, it just, you know, in smelling like mosquito repellent. And, you know, that's great. And then Hawaii is the other one, because my wife's mother grew up in Hawaii and we still have a bunch of family on Oahu. So we love to go to Hawaii together and, you know, eat Hawaiian food and just kind of hang out. So those are our two, those are kind of our two haunts.
Awesome. Speaking of food, Stinking Good Chili, sir, and queso. Of course, we'll put up links where people can, you know, go to stinkinggood.com. Favorite go-to meal using that? You know, back in the day when you were making your kids' lunches, it was aerosol cheese. Right. Now you got some Stinking Good Chili and queso. What's your go-to meal?
My go-to meal is using either the medium or hot pork, depending on who's there, and making Frito pies.
So,
you know, you just dump Fritos in a bowl, smother it in the pork green chili. And I like the hot pork green chili with some grated cheese. And I don't know why. I think it's scientific. You might disagree that grated cheese tastes way better than sliced cheese.
100%.
I think it's the air in the grated cheese. Like I get a block of Tillamook all the time. And I put it in my wife's Cuisinart and grate the whole thing and then just put it in the fridge. And like fresh grated cheese tastes way better than just regular. And I love cheese. So so that would be my go-to meal. But over eggs, over burritos and breakfast burritos and stuff, it's a phenomenal product. It really is.
You're right. It is a scientific fact. Shredded cheese is way better. It's totally, yes. Melts better, does everything better. So good.
There's no question.
And lastly, top three words you hope your kids would use to describe you as a dad, what would they be?
Top three words that you get me emotional. Loving, supportive, and then one phrase, if I texted any one of my three kids right now and say one thing that I have taught, all three of them will respond with the exact same response. Poop is always funny. That's all three of them. If I texted them right now, I could show you and said, one thing that I've taught you, they would all respond with poop is always funny.
Oh, I can't thank you enough. You've been so gracious with your time. People, make sure you follow Mark on Twitter at Mark Schlereth. Go to his website, stinkinggood.com, to purchase his chili and queso. And also, while you're online, check out his radio show on 104.3 The Fan in Denver. And also, I can't wait for football season starting, especially watching Breaking Down Things on Fox. It's been an honor chatting with you. I appreciate your fatherhood journey. You dropped a lot of gems, and I know a lot of people will appreciate it. And I wish you and your family continued success, sir.
All the best to you, man. It was a pleasure getting to talk to you, and we'll do it again sometime.
Cool. Sounds good. I hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the Art of Fatherhood podcast. If you would be so kind and leave a review and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, I greatly appreciate that. And thank you to our sponsor this week, Busy Kid. It's a great way to teach your kids about finances, chores, investing, so many great things. I had a chance to chat with one of the co-founders, Greg Merced. You can check out that interview here as well. Really appreciate them sponsoring this week's podcast. For more on them, go to busykid.com.
Thanks for listening to the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and go to artoffatherhood.net.